Hello, this is Dan Young. I am here in New Orleans in the Lower Ninth Ward in the basement of a gutted house, a common ground operation. I am here with Arissa Arend, is that the correct pronunciation? Who is, as far as I know it, a local New Orleans activist, a journalist, and to some degree a radical historian. So we're going to be interviewing her about various topics relating to the rebuilding of a more just and sustainable New Orleans. So to start out, Arissa, can you tell us what are your main current projects related to social change activism in the New Orleans area that you're to some degree involved with?
Okay, sure. Well, I'm supervising an AmeriCorps mediator unit. We recruited some local grassroots people of color who have been working in New Orleans as activists even before the storm. And our idea was to try to channel a little bit of resources and support to these organizations and people that are usually outside of the ordinary funding stream. So that's one of the things I'm doing right now. I'm also trying to write about the history as it unfolds here. I've been involved in St. Augustine Catholic Church about a year ago. I'm part of that congregation. About a year ago, we took a stand to save the church when the archdiocese tried to shut it down. And that was a successful effort, so I've been writing about that also. And then just trying to record the history of the beginning of Common Ground, both the relief part and particularly the health clinic, which I've been a little bit more involved in. I'm a mediator and a psychotherapist, and I'm the project director for Community Mediation Services, which is a small nonprofit group here.
Great, yeah. Well, to start with, could you tell us a little bit more about what Community Mediation Services does?
Sure. We do any kind of mediation or facilitation, training, in anything really that anybody asks us to do. It could be a dispute between neighbors or between contractors and between landlords and tenants. Or most recently, we actually did a mediation between two neighborhood groups. There are a lot of organizations working together in New Orleans, and we've never been particularly good at working together. And now there's some really strange bedfellows. So there's just a whole lot of layers of cultural misunderstanding and other kinds of misunderstanding. And so just as an example, we mediated between Neighborhood Housing Services and a new cultural organization in the 7th Ward called The Porch. They were building a community center and doing various things together, and they just did a great job after they understood what some of the barriers were that were creating the problems. I've forgotten what else you asked me.
Just ask you about community mediation.
Oh, right. So most people in New Orleans don't really know much about mediation. They don't really know what it is, so we don't get a lot of calls. We're trying to spread the word about it. It's a wonderful collaborative approach to problem solving. Often things can conflicts just get buried, or they go to violence, or they go to court. And this is a very old-fashioned method of sitting down with all the parties involved and allowing them to come up with a solution to their own problem after hearing each other out, which is a very difficult thing to do. It really requires some assistance, usually, from a trained mediator or a team of mediators. So we're available for that, and we will, you know, train people in how to mediate. We'll train school kids into how to mediate their own disputes at their school or on the playground. we'll train anybody in any of the community organizations to mediate, and it's all on a sliding scale, so it's just according to what the individual or the organization can afford. We have some extremely experienced mediators, and all of them have been trained in undoing racism, so they have some understanding of the cultural dynamics. And as an organization, I think we're the first to offer specifically conflict resolution for race-related disputes. We were offering that even before the storm, and, you know, we're finding that's something that's very much needed now. We've been in existence since 1994. We're very small. We don't have an office space. We don't have any paid staff. It's pretty much when somebody wants us to do something, we kind of look for a grant and do it, or we do it for free. Whatever. At one point, we brought the former New Orleans Black Panthers together, and we had a forum with the city officials that were present in 1970. When there was a shootout on Piety Street and a standoff in Desire that actually ended without anybody getting killed or going to jail, which was amazing in those days for Panther activities. So at one point we put together for schools and civic groups and a conflict, we called it Conflict Resolution New Orleans Style. And Malik Rahim, who's a former Panther, and Robert King Wilkerson, who is also a former Panther and was incarcerated in Angola for 3 decades, and would go out and talk to school groups and community groups about conflict resolution. And obviously, they know a lot about it, having been through all those experiences.
So, yeah. Yeah, that's wonderful. Could you tell us, I guess, this, hopefully this interview will end up being heard by some local New Orleans residents, perhaps over we'll be distributing it through the Common Ground webpage. So just so that's in there, you want to put out the contact information for community mediation services so people can find you if they need help?
Sure. You can, was that a rat? Call me at area code 504-865-1619 or email me. Again, my name is Orissa, O-R-I-S-S-A-A-R-E-N-D. My email is arendsaxer, A-R-E-N-D-S-A-X-E-R. At bellsouth.net. And, you know, we'd be glad to answer any additional questions or provide information that you might need.
Great, great. Did you have a question, Ian? No? Just go on. Okay. So the listeners aren't confused. My co-interviewer here is Ian Mays, by the way, who will be joining in with some questions later. And so you're also not confused. This interview should be going out on the Common Ground Media website, and also on my personal, the Noia Radio Project, a podcast page, and being aired on KNYO, the Noia Radio Project radio station in Mendocino, California. But, that's why listeners may be confused by different references to different things. And, it's just a mouse. Don't worry. it's not a rat. We're in a gutted building in the one of the most devastated zones, right next to where the levees broke in the lower ninth ward, during Hurricane Katrina, or following Hurricane Katrina. So, to get back to Orissa, can you tell us a little bit more about the AmeriCorps project? And you said that through that you were bringing a lot of resources into, places where they wouldn't normally get in terms of mediation, and we'd love to hear about that.
Okay. Well, this is really a collaborative project between Community Mediation Services, which is our small local group, and the National Association for Community Mediation, NAFCM, which is based in Washington, D.C. And it provides networking and assistance and small grants to mediation centers around the country. And then the third partner in the group is AmeriCorps, which is a national service corps, a little bit like a domestic peace corps. It provides AmeriCorps volunteers, or members as we call them, with a small stipend that they get every other week. And then at the end of their service term, which is usually a year, they receive an education award of about between $4,000 and $5,000. And so we had never worked with NAFCM here in New Orleans. Community Mediation Services hadn't. But right after Katrina, Joanne Galindo from NAFCM contacted me and said that they would like to help New Orleans in some way, and would we like to have some AmeriCorps volunteers? And I said, well, you know, that depends on what it involves, because we can't really take on another project here. We're just so overwhelmed. We don't have an office space. In fact, nobody has office space, and nobody can do any extra volunteer work. So I was really pretty pessimistic about it. But they thought they could, you know, get us some supervision money and some training money and provide us with some resources. And at the time, I was sort of helping out with Common Ground, both the relief and the medical clinic. And I was just so impressed with the volunteers that were coming in from around the country and how little they really needed to survive here that I wanted to do anything I could to support their efforts. So my idea was to hire them as AmeriCorps members if we could get the program going. And that would allow them, you know, a little cushion for their organizing efforts. But as it turned out, NAFCM was overly optimistic about being able to get Katrina money. And so we really didn't have any. But at that point, we'd gotten so excited about having the AmeriCorps money that we decided, well, we'll just try it without any particular structure or funding and see what happens. And it really worked extremely well. We had four part-time volunteers from both the relief part of Common Ground and the health clinic. And they worked tirelessly, night and day. And the little stipend allowed them to not have to go out and get part-time jobs as a waitress or bartender or something, which would have taken them away from their organizing tasks. They rode bicycles, they slept in tents, they, you know, were extremely resourceful in making do with almost nothing. So, plus I have a lot of friends who are mediators and trainers, and they were more than willing to train them. And I was surprised because I thought they'd be so tied up with what they were doing that they wouldn't even have that much time for training, but it turned out they were very interested in learning to be mediators. One of them, Stevie Peace, I just got an email from the other day, and he's working in a restorative justice program. Anyway, they made great use of the training, and we talked NAFCM into coming to New Orleans to do the national training because they usually do it in D.C., and we thought it would be good to have it done here. So they did that. The second year we got lucky because Mercy Corps noticed what we were doing and asked us to apply for some money. And then they gave it to us with, you know, not much trouble. They hired a consultant to help me write the grant because I really don't like grant writing. I think it's kind of like a gambling addiction or something. I really hate to do it. But anyway, they were very supportive, and they gave us, you know, I think $20,000 for supervision and $10,000 for NAFCM, and they told us that they would help us secure money for the future. But, and this is why I hate writing grants, and you know, I'm very grateful to Mercy Corps. But you know, then they packed up their bags and left town, like so many people do, and they didn't really help us continue our funding. So this is our third year, and we're back to square one, with just you know, trying to do what we can do without funds, except that the program has really mushroomed. and my original AmeriCorps members who were very involved with grassroots activities here, things like Safe Streets, Strong Communities, and Survivors Village, and the Ninth Ward Health Clinic, not Lower Ninth, but Ninth Ward Health Clinic, and the Women's Health Clinic that was started by Inside Women of Color. Organizations like that, they thought that really the AmeriCorps positions should be passed on to the people in those organizations. So we decided to contact those organizations and ask them if they would be interested in an AmeriCorps position and if they would be willing to select a person that they think would do well with that. So this is our third year, and now we have 8 people from these different organizations who have just signed on as of September, and they've been through the NAFCOM training, which again was in New Orleans in a French Quarter hotel where we all stayed for a week, and I have lots of stories about that. And then they've had also some mediation training, and they're doing grassroots activist and outreach work in their various locations, and I'm just kind of the overall supervisor. So that's what's going on with that. We're really excited about having such a diverse group. It interestingly enough, it turned out to be mostly men, mostly guys. We only have one woman. All people of color, all of the new ones are people of color. I talked Justin Stein into staying on for a second year for AmeriCorps because I really needed his help with the transition. But he's the only white member. All of them, I think all of them, maybe all of them, but one or two have been through the Undoing Racism workshop that the People's Institute puts on. And they're just doing great things.
Hello, my name is Ian Mays. I'm a co-interviewer here. So a question that I have here is, what techniques or procedures do you use for mediation? How do you practically go about mediation process?
Okay, well, you'll have to come to our next workshop because that's a big question. I don't know how much you or your listeners know about mediation, but basically a mediator is a third-party neutral. And so it depends. Depending on the mediation, that's how you decide who needs to be at the table. We usually try to co-mediate, and for instance, I wouldn't, mediate with teenage kids or something like that. I would try to get somebody that has to either co-mediate or mediate themselves, somebody that has some credibility with the particular group that has the dispute. And then it's just basically a process of letting each side say what the problem is from their point of view, making sure that the other side understands exactly what it is from the other's point of view. Sometimes in a mediation session, people are able to exchange, hear, or give or receive information that they haven't been able to give or receive without, the safety of some kind of structure. Not all disputes, of course, are amenable to mediation. The best things for mediation are situations where people really need to have an ongoing relationship and that they have some kind of a common goal and that both of them are completely willing to go through the process in good faith. And it can take one session. Actually, some of the mediations we've done, for instance, have been within common ground, because I'm sure y'all have probably been here long enough to notice that when you're doing this kind of work and under these difficult circumstances and you're working with people that you might not have known before, there can be some power and control issues that that come up and decision-making processes. And, you know, I've seen everybody from anarchists to, you know, very, you know, regimented healthcare professionals that are used to going by the book. That's what we've had at the clinic. And so a lot of our mediation has been internal kinds of things. I don't know whether I answered your question very much, but for anybody that hasn't studied mediation, it's a wonderful skill to have, even just to use in your personal life informally or in your relationships. And it's based on, you know, some fairly standard communication techniques, active listening and how to negotiate, those kinds of things. But it's a good reminder, and it's a way of putting what you probably already know into sort of a systematic usefulness.
And another question I have is, could you say a bit about your personal history of involvement with Common Ground and the Common Ground Health Clinic?
Okay. Yeah, sure. My involvement with Common Ground comes through my friendship and with and actually working with Malik Rahim. Before the storm, we had been something called the Anti-Violence Coordinating Committee, which was a little sort of subcommittee of community mediation services. And it evolved after we had the Black Panther Forum here in 2003. Originally, I was writing a newspaper column for the Louisiana Weekly. I did that for about 6 years, and in the process of writing that opinion column, I had come just sort of accidentally in contact with the Panther story, the local Black Panther story. And it was actually through Robert King Wilkerson, who is a very good friend of Malik's. They grew up, you know, as boys in Algiers, and their backyards touched. And then they went to Orleans Parish Prison together. Well, they were in there together. They didn't go together. Malik went as a result of the Piety Street shootout, and King was already in prison for something else. And he was in Orleans Parish Prison after he had led a jailbreak. But anyway, I was interviewing King, actually, for an article in the Weekly, and his partner, Marion Brown, just happened to be there the day I went. Well, actually, I wasn't interviewing him that day at all. We had gotten to be friends, and he makes these wonderful freelanes, which are pralines, and he perfected that recipe, if you can believe this, in solitary confinement in Angola. He would make the stove out of Coke cans and toilet tissue. So I had learned about the freelanes, and they're delicious, so I was over there buying some for Thanksgiving, and Marion was there, and she, for some reason, just started talking about the Black Panthers, and I didn't know anything about them. But I happened to have my tape recorder with me, and she was nice enough and open enough to let me turn it on, and so she started talking about it, and of course she was talking a lot about Malik because he was a central part of that story. And so then from there we set up a three-way interview, and I got to know Malik a little better, and we put on the Forum for Reconciliation at Ashe Cultural Arts Center in 2003. And after that, we had become, all of us that worked on putting on that forum had become really sort of bonded as a result of that. So we continued to meet weekly every Wednesday and called ourselves the Anti-Violence Coordinating Committee. Malik was a part of that. So after the storm hit, we were looking for King because he lived in Mid-City and nobody had heard from him, and it was 2 weeks. And as resourceful as he is, you know, I was worried that he was dead. And he's really good at staying in touch, and he hadn't gotten in touch with Malik. And miraculously, Malik's landline worked. So I had called Malik to try to find out about King and couldn't find out anything for a while. But then my son Jonathan, who is very, very attached to New Orleans, and he's was doing a community medicine residency in New York, and FEMA and Red Cross said, you know, they didn't really need doctors, if you can believe that. And did I know of anything, you know, any way that he could help? And he was really thinking of going to some kind of shelter in Houston or Baton Rouge or something. And I said, but he knew, you know, that I was kind of active in circles here. So I kind of put my head under the pillow and thought about it a while. And then I called Malik and I said, you know, can you use a doctor here? And he said, well, as a matter of fact, we just started a first aid station. But Rita was out in the Gulf then, so he said, we're telling people not to come in until we know where Rita's going. But Jonathan just had a week off, and we were in a rented house in Luling at the time. So Jonathan decided to come on down, and I said, you know, you might have to evacuate again with us, and I have no idea whether this first aid station, you know, it can't be very organized. I mean, it's only 11 days after the storm, you know, and I don't know what it'll be like, but he wanted to give it a try. He was excited about it. So he flew down, and we went through all the barriers, and it was a mandatory evacuation then. They weren't letting anybody into Jefferson Parish or Orleans. But we pretty quickly discovered that, you know, if you have some kind of permission to go in, I mean, you can write it up yourself on the computer, and if it's laminated, they think it's official. So we would, you know, create these things over in Luling, but actually Jonathan's stethoscope was pretty much what got us through all the barriers. And so I drove him. Rita hadn't struck yet, and we got rain gear. We stopped at a dollar store. We couldn't believe we had found rain gear, but that's what Malik wanted. So we made the run down to Algiers and went through all the barriers and tucked our way. I was terrified because those guards with guns really scare me. But anyway, they let us through, I think, because of, you know, Jonathan was a doctor, and also because we were white. It was pretty easy to get around if you were white, and it was almost impossible if you were black. So I dropped him off down there at the mosque, which was the first aid station then, and he spent the whole week there, and I would come back and forth and see what was going on. And, you know, I was just amazed at what they were doing. They were, you know, making house calls on their bicycles and, you know, giving people essential medications. And, I mean, you'd sit there at the mosque and look down the street in Algiers, and all of a sudden you'd see these two or three, you know, precious little girls in scrubs dragging their luggage behind them. And, you know, it's like, who are you and where did you come from? And they were like, oh, we're residents from San Francisco. You know, how in the world did you get here? It was just amazing. So that's how I got involved with Common Ground Health Clinic. Just, you know, fell in love with the volunteers. And, of course, nobody had any place to stay then. And we had a place in Luling, so we could put a lot of people up. And then about a month later, we could actually move into our house in New Orleans and help out that way. And so, you know, I just, from then on, I've tried to do everything I can do to help both Common Ground and the clinic and the relief. And Malik was amazing in those days. He was everywhere and doing everything. And, you know, things seemed to kind of click.
Wonderful. Thank you for that story. And the next thing I was going to ask, and I'm always really interested in what, this is going in a different direction, but in what kind of personal life history, formative experiences people have that lead them to become interested in different kinds of social change, radical social change. So anything, I'd love to hear anything about yourself, about how you got interested in that and got involved with that.
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, as a psychotherapist, I always, you know, think about these things. And, you know, in one way, I mean, I come from a family where that's, you know, that's what's done. My father was a congressman from Texas that kind of bucked segregation way back when. And, you know, I can remember going to black churches with him, and the death threats and those kinds of things. But I've never been very political. And in fact, I really shied away from activism. I lived in New Orleans in 1970. I was 24 years old and I was teaching school and recently married, and I just lost my eye to cancer, and I was, you know, very like self-absorbed. And I mean, if you can believe this, I didn't even know that the Panther incident was going on. I was completely oblivious. So, you know, when I was y'all's age, I was not an activist. You know, I was sort of like minding my own business. And that's really what I did until I was, I guess, well into my 40s. And I really sort of, I think there were some seeds of activism planted there just in terms of my family values, but it was definitely not part of my history. You know, I was just sort of minding my business, doing a private practice in psychotherapy uptown New Orleans, going to Trinity Church, and, you know, just sort of a very, raising my kids, and my first husband was a doctor, you know, being a good doctor's wife, that sort of thing. But anyway, I really credit the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond for sort of bringing me into the activist fold. I went through that workshop. And then as a result of my job at Trinity Church, I was supervising some interns in social work. We were part of something called the St. Thomas Irish Channel Consortium, which was a group of St. Thomas leaders and the People's Institute and service providers in the neighborhood, including Trinity Church and Kingsley House and the St. Thomas Health Clinic and Kingsley House. And so as a result of that training and that work with STIC, it just fascinated me, and it became sort of like this passion, the undoing racism work and the activism that was required to do that became just sort of a passion. I learned at the same time to be a mediator, so I had those skills that I tried to incorporate with that, and I just kept going to workshops, and Ron Chisholm has been one of my mentors over the years. And then when I had an opportunity to write for a couple of the black publications here locally, I intentionally used my writing as a vehicle for activism. So, that's really what got me into it. And now I guess I'm just hooked.
Wonderful. I'm not really very familiar with the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond or Undoing Racism or Ron Chisholm. So could you tell us about all these groups and people and things?
Well, how in the world could you be in New Orleans, or in fact be anywhere, because they're based in New Orleans, but they do their trainings all over the country. And, bless his heart. I mean, for a while, Malik was trying to get all of his volunteers to go through the workshop or at least have a taste of the workshop. And they would do something when Rebecca Mintz, who was one of my mediators, she would organize things on Mondays, every Monday, for the volunteers that were streaming in. And it's a community organizing and an undoing racism 2.5-day training that's been going on for about 30 years. The trainers are incredibly good at what they do. It deals with systemic racism, really more than personal prejudice. And it creates a common vocabulary, because a lot of people sort of, use racial prejudice and racism, indiscriminately. And it's, run by people of color, but it's the team is interracial. They've done workshops on Indian reservations, and it happens here on a quarterly basis, the regional trainings. They can do it for specialized groups, and I have put together some for the mental health community and different things. And I guess I've been through the workshop maybe 35 times. I'm kind of a slow learner. And each time I go, I learn something. It never gets old. It's basically the same workshop. I guess they're a little bit nicer to white people than they used to be 30 years ago, but it's basically the same workshop they've always done. And it's wonderful, and it's particularly important for people like you all who are white and not part of the community here and have come in, you know, to do this wonderful work that you're doing. To just it helped me really understand what white privilege is and understand that unless I know how it came to be and unless I know how I participate in it, my organizing is not going to be effective.
Wonderful. And who was Ron Chisholm?
Well, Ron Chisholm is one of the founders. He and Jim Dunn, who is deceased now, started the People's Institute about 30 or 35 years ago. And, gosh, I think he's back in New Orleans. He lived in Houston for a long time after the storm. The People's Institute office most recently was out in New Orleans East, and it was completely swept away. So, but they're back and up and running and doing wonderful things. And really quickly after the storm, I asked him, you know, to do it for Common Ground, to do the training, a 2.5-day training for Common Ground, which we did at St. Augustine Church. And so we've done several that included Common Ground and included Malik. And one thing that's really exciting is that on the West Bank, the Common Ground Health Clinic has pulled together a group of key black organizers in Algiers who are interested in the workshop, particularly they say we're kind of on a cusp with money pouring in to the West Bank for various projects, both federal and state money. And they want to make sure that the residents of Algiers have a primary say in how that money is spent. So we've had two Undoing Racism workshops now at the Craig Cultural Center on the West Bank in Algiers, and that's the first time that there's ever been an Undoing Racism workshop in that part of New Orleans. So we're real excited about that.
All right, I want to remind all our listeners, if anybody's listening to this on the radio and just tuned in, this is Dan Young here live in New Orleans with Arissa Arend, and we're sitting here in the basement of a gutted house just near where the levee broke. This is a house that actually stopped the barge that floated through the break in the levee. And as my lungs fill with dust here in the basement of the house, we'll go on with the interview. And the next question I wanted to ask you, Arissa, was you mentioned this moments ago or a few minutes ago about how you, back in 1970, you weren't even aware of the incident with the Panthers. And for our listeners that maybe some local New Orleans listeners and most who aren't familiar with that incident either. Whether you've written a wonderful historical document, which I've read some of, the showdown at Desire, is that in Desire, about it. And I guess, would be great if you could just give us a brief, tell us a little bit about that briefly, what that is and how you came to write that.
Okay. As I mentioned before, it really came about through a series of opinion columns I was doing for the Louisiana Weekly. And I started to collect these oral interviews because, and the more I heard, the more fascinated I was with the story. And then there was a lot of serendipity involved, too. It turned out that my next-door neighbor and good friend, an Episcopal priest, William Barnwell, was one of the, he tried to be a mediator between the Panthers and police, and he had written about it in his autobiography. And then the Catholic priest, where I went to church sometimes at St. Augustine Church, was another one of those. And then I ran into Moon Landrieu, who was mayor at the time in 1970, when I was campaigning for Mary for Senate, and he said that he would give me an interview. So I sat down with him and heard the story from his point of view. And I had also talked to several of the lawyers for the Panthers. New Orleans is an odd place. I mean, 33 years later, there were so many of the key players that were still here and still doing wonderful, wonderful things. So I was, for some reason, entrusted with this story, and I just, you know, carried my tape recorder around and asked people questions about it and started piecing it together. And as it started coming out in columns in the weekly, I got a call from Bob Tucker, who's a local businessman here. And at the time, he had been a part of the Landrieu administration, one of the first black people with any kind of power in city government. He was 24 at the time. So he said, there's a whole nother piece of this story that I think you might be interested in. And I said, well, I sure would. So he pulled together an interview with Don Hubbard at the Hubbard Mansion on St. Charles Street, one of the few black-owned properties on St. Charles Street, and Henry Fagan, who had been a resident in Desire at the time and a civic leader. They dubbed him the mayor of Desire. So, and Cecil Carter, who also worked in the Landrieu administration. So he pulled together that interview for me, and I found out a whole bunch more stuff. So I put together, when I had about 44 of these columns, I put most of them together in this booklet, and then people kept saying, well, you really ought to write a book about it. So I didn't know how to write a book because I'd never written a book, and I'm not really an academic, but I finally figured out that, well, if you just outline it and break it down into chapters, it's not that different from writing a term paper or column. So that was the next thing, is that I went to the library and I read the newspaper accounts of the time and filled in some of the blanks that I didn't know, and I wrote a book. And it's right now at the University of Arkansas Press is looking at it. They've had it out to one reader, and they're waiting for feedback from another reader, and I've had a lot of help with it. The Panther scholars, Curtis Austin and Charles Jones, have really, really helped me, and they've written introductions for the book, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities has helped me, and I've had some great editing help. So all the, you know, the stars seem to have aligned to get this story together. And actually, after I had written the whole thing, for some reason, the undercover cops who had infiltrated the Panther Party and who had not wanted to talk to me previously, they finally, a couple of them decided to talk to me. So I even have their perspective on it. So I really have gotten to know these two incidents, the shootout on Piety Street and then the standoff in Desire. And, you know, Desire is a street, and it was the name of the largest housing project at the time. It had like 10,000 people living in it in 1970, mostly children, and that was the Panther headquarters. They were holed up in there, and the police department said that they couldn't be there because they weren't a real family. And so they were going to evict them. This would be the third eviction. They had already been evicted from St. Thomas and then from Piety Street, which is right on the outskirts of Desire.
Is it a housing project?
St. Thomas is a housing project. Piety, don't you love the street names here? Piety and Desire, you know. So I didn't even have to come up with names for these books. But Piety is a street that is right next to Desire. I mean, as you come out here, you'll pass both of those streets. But the Panthers had been evicted twice, and, you know, once ending in that shootout on Piety Street, so they had moved into the Desire Housing Project. And, you know, that's when my friend William Barnwell and my friend Father Jerome Ledoux and tried to talk them into leaving peacefully, or tried to talk them into having their rent paid by the clergy, but no, they weren't having any of it. They were staying there, and, you know, and they were putting sandbags up and fortifying. They had tons of weapons in their headquarters, but the police said that, you know, they had to leave. So they actually sent in 250 policemen in riot gear, armed, white, and a war wagon. I mean, they had this strange tank-looking thing, and helicopters, and National Guard. And they went in to, you know, serve an eviction notice. You know, the fine for trespassing was like $50. Well, they sent a small army in. And, you know, everybody thought that if this happened, there would surely be a bloodbath. That's why the mediators tried so hard. But nothing worked. And I have all the, you know, conversations of how that went in my book, because the people that were there remembered all this. I mean, 33 years later, they remembered it word for word, and I'd hear it from two or three different people, and it would be the same conversation. It was just amazing. But anyway, and Clarence Giarusso, who, bless his heart, just died about 2 weeks ago. I even got an interview with him. And he was, you know, for 1970, he was a great police chief. Anyway, he was there himself. Moon Landry wasn't there, but he had sent Bob Tucker and some Charlie Elwha and some different people in. But anyway, the Desire residents surrounded the Panther headquarters in the housing development. And they were mostly kids, and they didn't have guns. They weren't armed. They just stood there and said, "You're not going to arrest them." And they stood there for 4 hours. And there were, I don't know how many fingers on triggers. And finally, Moon Landrieu, and, you know, he was talking to Bob and talking to Henry Fagan and talking to everybody that was on the ground in Desire, and they said, you know, put the policemen back on buses and send them back to headquarters, because we have to get them out of there before dark, and we can't arrest the Panthers, and there would be a bloodbath. And so they went home, and, you know, there was dancing in the streets in Desire that night. And it felt like, you know, a big win for the Panthers, and especially because they had been protected by the community and for the community itself. But then a week later, you know what the cops did? They disguised themselves as priests and postmen. This was on Thanksgiving morning at 1:30 in the morning. And they barged into, that's how they gained access to the Panther headquarters. And when they got up there, and Betty Powell, one of the Panthers, was in there, and she realized when she started to open the door that it wasn't postmen and priests. Yeah. And she tried to close the door, and they shot her in the shoulder. She still got the buckshot in her shoulder. And they went in and they arrested all of them in the middle of the night that way. And then there was a huge outcry that mainly in the religious community, because the real priests figured that they had, you know, that this had just was just an insult and had taken away all of their street credibility. But anyway, that's...
All right. We got some... I don't know if you can hear that on mic. We got some noise going on upstairs. The next question that I had... I'm sorry. Thank you so much for sharing that story. That was very interesting. Oh, and I guess Ian has an interjection.
One question I have about your work that you do currently in New Orleans is I hear that you do a weekly session of question and answering and guidance for nonprofits and social activists here in New Orleans. Something called Nonprofit Central?
Oh,
all that. Yeah, I was wondering if you could say a bit more about that work.
Oh, sure. This actually is not not mine at all, but I do try to participate every Monday. There is something called Nonprofit Central, and it's kind of amazing because the nonprofits before the storm in New Orleans were very competitive with each other, you know, fighting for a very small piece of the pie, which wasn't very large either. And, you know, as with many things after the storm, it was kind of collaborate or sink. So this is a place on Aretha Castle Haley. I can't remember the address right offhand, but it's called Nonprofit Central, where all nonprofit providers can come together every week and let people know what they're doing, talk about any job openings that they have. Different people have volunteered to give trainings of various sorts if people need to know how to write grants. It's a great place to network. So that's, you know, one of the real pluses of the storm is that we all get together now, and there's a website and all sorts of training. And they were, Nonprofit Central was kind enough to offer community mediation services, some space, meeting space for our AmeriCorps program. And for a long time, we had a display table there and wonderful conference rooms and things like that.
All right. So my next question was that, the general theme of these interviews, of which this is just the first one, but we hope to do many with different people in New Orleans, is basically the theme is about how to rebuild a more just and sustainable New Orleans. And we wanted to know if you had any ideas or thoughts on that process.
Well, I have, you know, some just general thoughts, which is, as I say, my main passion is the undoing racism. And I know that a lot of the country, you know, all of you all are out there that aren't New Orleanians, you know, probably think we're the most racist place around. And it's, you know, it's true that Katrina really pulled the cover off of the problems that we have with poverty and with racism here, and particularly how those are interwoven in New Orleans. I actually think we're a lot less racist than most places, although we might not be as subtle about it. We might not be as politically correct about it. But I think that is the absolute key in rebuilding. Of course, well, let me back up a little and say this. I think that we've gone through three traumas or disasters here in the last couple of years. One was the natural disaster, and one was the man-made disaster, the levee breaking and all of that. And then in addition to that, there's an ongoing trauma that I would really characterize as ethnic group trauma. And it started, if any of you have seen the Welcome to New Orleans video that I guess is on the Common Ground website, that kind of stars Malik and shows what things were like in Algiers with the white vigilantes and people not being allowed to cross the Gretna Bridge. And in other words, during that time when we were all, you know, fighting for our lives in a sense, and sometimes in a very literal sense, we all became very much, well, there were two things that happened. We either collaborated in fabulous ways and became one family, or we became very tribal. And you sort of saw the best and the worst of people in those things. But I think that this ethnic group trauma and the fact that the black middle class has been, it's just been much harder for black poor people or black middle class to participate here and recover and come back. And then there's a lot of speculation, and a lot of it may be true, that there was an actual conspiracy to make this a white city again. And that hasn't happened, and I don't think it will happen, but I think as we as we negotiate these issues of recovery, I think racism, dealing with racism openly and fairly and getting rid of it to the extent that we can is the most, if I had to say that one thing was the most important part of our recovery in terms of the justice, I would say that that's it. And I think, you know, I'm very hopeful for New Orleans because we have some cultural advantages that other places don't have. And we have some geographical advantages with blacks and whites. And now we have a wonderful component of Latinos that have come to help us rebuild. And the Vietnamese have recovered more quickly as an ethnic group than some of the other groups. So if we can figure out a way to capitalize, that's not the word I want to use, but you know what I mean, use this stuff to our advantage rather than creating the same old divisions that we've lived with forever. And frankly, the same old divisions don't really wash these days. And we have a lot of new people here that can, like, see right through the stupid ways that we did things before the storm. And we did a lot of stupid things before the storm. And that's why I love the fact that people from outside are here and people with new ideas and people that are, you know, sort of more idealistic than we are. We had become kind of cynical about how things are here. So I think dealing with racism would be the primary component of a just rebuilding.
Wonderful. Did you have something, Ian?
I guess one more question. So what would your ideal for a just and sustainable New Orleans look like? Just like paint a picture about what it is you're going for.
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, that's tough because I want New Orleans to stay New Orleans. I don't really want it to change. I want the character of every neighborhood to stay the way it always was, including this one. And how can it? I mean, I'm looking around and I'm sitting in the lower Ninth Ward and, you know, there's nothing here. But I want, you know, I desperately want New Orleans to stay the way it was in terms of the neighborhoods. I want everybody to be able to participate. You know, the crime sucks. You know, I want the crime, like, gone. I don't want any of it. I want us to protect each other and take care of each other and not look at it as somebody else's problem. You know, when I want the education system to be fixed. I want for, you know, us white privileged people, many of whom are sending our kids to private schools that live uptown, I want us to just demand that everybody can have the same, as good an education as our kids can have for free. You know, I want it to work financially for people. I'd love to see more homeowners, and I think we have a real opportunity for that to happen if there's the political will. But, you know, I want to be able to walk to my grocery store. I want to know all my neighbors. And I want y'all that are here from out of town to, like, fall in love with New Orleans and stay here. I want everybody to, you know, that has a spirit and a willingness and an interest in New Orleans, that loves New Orleans. I want those people to be here because we desperately need that. I mean, we're still kind of on life support.
All right. I really, really deeply want to thank you, Arissa, for coming and doing this interview. It's been really wonderful and inspiring to hear your stories. I want to thank my co-interviewer, Ian Mays, and all the listeners and the people at Common Ground, with whom I'm working on this project. And that's all I have to say. Did Ian and Arissa have anything else you wanted to add?
I just wanted to add a thank you. It's a real special thank you to you all for getting this word out. There's nothing more important right now.